Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 156 on negotiating no money down commercial real estate deals with Peter Conti. This episode has personally been one of my most anticipated. Peter has written quite a few well-known books that a lot of real estate investors around the United States have made a lot of money on. The knowledge over the last 20 or so years since they were written. Those books are on little or no money down deals specifically, and I've read them all. The first of which was back in 2006 before I did my first deal. I've always considered Peter to be a blessing to my real estate career, and those books have been some of my most personally recommended to people over the years who want to make money doing real estate deals. And a first ever for the REI Diamond Show, I am experimenting here right now with a new long form uncut format, allowing us to go much deeper than usual into our topic, a format I'll likely return to in the future when the guest and topic warrant deep exploration. For you loyal listeners of the show, I will also tag the long form episodes in the future as long form gold. So if you go to reidiamonds.com and check out the catalog, you'll notice the categories on the right hand side, and one of which will be long form gold. Any episode that I tag as such, you can consider my official highlighting of that episode and the content we discuss. I digress. Back to today's episode. Peter and I dive deep into his method for negotiating deals, specifically subject to and lease option deals. Subject to, meaning subject to the mortgage payments, aka the mortgage takeover, and lease options being used by Peter to secure unusually large deals ranging from $600,000 or so nice homes in nice areas like San Diego, all the way up through the commercial space to as many as a 300-unit apartment building with very little or even no money out of pocket. I've personally used this exact strategy to take over mortgage payments myself on many deals over the years. While I've explained this process to my partners and effectively closed those deals using this exact process, it has been a true pleasure to have Peter come on the show, the creator and master of this method, and explain in full detail its proper execution. And it's also been a pleasure to have a chance to thank Peter publicly on the REI Diamond Show for unknowingly planting some of those seeds of success of my own way back in 2006. Buckle up, my friends. We are about to roll. All right. Welcome to the REI Diamond Show, Mr. Peter Conti. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Dan. How are you doing?
All things considered, cooped up in the house like the rest of us here with the COVID thing going on. I'm blessed to be healthy, and so are all my family and friends. So, you know, I don't know if I could ask for a whole lot more.
Yeah, likewise here. We're doing good. We do the Zoom call on Saturday with the whole family, and we're having fun developing some more of these virtual investing ideas that everyone's wanted to do anyway. So we're making the most of it.
Yeah, true enough. So anyway, for people who don't already know who you are, Peter, do you want to kind of give the backstory and then maybe just a little bit of what your business looks like today?
Sure. I started investing in 1990, and I was working as an auto mechanic. I came from a family of seven kids, and they basically got us all together and said, "We think you should all go to college. We obviously can't help you. Good luck." And so I kind of made my way and, you know, hadn't gone to college, was working as an auto mechanic, but I wanted to do more. And I, you know, read some books about real estate and realized maybe I could, you know, if other people could do it, I figured if I could just follow what they did, I might have to work two or three times as hard as they did, but I could eventually get there. And so I got going and you used a lot of creative strategies over the years to get into doing commercial real estate, and then had, you know, a lot of houses and lease purchase deals all over the country and stuff. And it's been a really fun time. I've enjoyed all the time in real estate investing, and I've had some changes over the last, we'll say decade, that have affected my life in a big way. Maybe we can touch on those a little bit later. But my thing has always been the creative side of things. You know, I have bought properties with down payments and new loans, but most of what I've done and most of what I've helped people with over the years has been creative stuff, you know, in commercial master lease, owner carry financing, buying subject to leaving the existing financing in place, stuff like that.
So I first heard the auto mechanic story back in 2006 or 2007, if I had to guess. And I didn't mention this before We hopped on our show, but this was an interesting episode. I've been looking forward to this for a long time to have you on the show here. In 2006, I got in the business. I guess I was running pay-per-click ads. And someone from your office called out of the blue, and they're like, hey, you know, we got these investing books, da 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 da, and we're going to send you one. I'm like, okay. It just seemed like kind of a scam. And I didn't have money to, like, engage for any of the, you know, the further stuff, but I did get making big money in foreclosures without the use of your own cash or credit. And I was broke, and I was on, like, a Greyhound bus on my way upstate Pennsylvania to I was going to, you know, flip houses with this partner up there in Allentown or something. And I'm like, I'm reading your book, and I'm like reading the stories in there, reading your story. And I remember feeling so inspired at the time, Peter. Like, I wanted to just get off at the next stop, and I felt empowered. Like, I could just march down any street, start knocking on doors, and, like, put a deal together. And shortly thereafter, I ended up doing some other deals and built the business a little bit different. But I did. Thank you for sending the book. I never even paid for the book, but it was very impactful for me. The knowledge, the information, the language patterns, everything that was in that book was phenomenal.
Oh, you're welcome. And hallelujah. That's what I'm about, is if I can help somebody, you know, those of you listening to this podcast today, if I can somehow stir a little something in your heart or give you a little kick in the rear, or hopefully share some ideas you can use to go out and make things happen, that does wonders for me. There's another one of these big gurus out there. He told me the story. He went into the bookstore and read my book, or read a chapter of it in the bookstore, didn't buy it, went out and made $50,000. And he said, I didn't buy your book, but I made lots of money. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I bought all the books eventually. Yeah.
I love being able to affect a change in someone's life, because I feel like I'm just incredibly lucky, special, blessed for being an auto mechanic and being able to figure out this real estate thing and go out and not only have fun with it myself, but be able to, encourage other people all across the country to go out and give it a whirl and see if they could start being in charge of their life and having fun like we do with real estate. It's awesome. I have to just, I don't know. I can't believe it sometimes. Life's been very good to me.
Nice. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. So I figured there's one thing I remember. I don't remember if it was from that book, because like I said, I read them all. This is going back years. But if we could touch on first the 5-step instant offer system, and then for the guests listening, we can maybe talk about the commercial deals and some of the master leases, because that's really interesting stuff too. So do you think we could start with the 5-step?
Yeah, absolutely. The instant offer system is a system we developed to give anyone a template to run on when they are putting a deal together, whether it's with houses or commercial properties. And the thing that holds it all together is the very first step, which is creating rapport. And creating rapport, to me, is about making friends fast. So people who are in good rapport, people who are friends, people hang out together, couples have been together a long time, they have a lot of similarities And some of that is because, you know, you meet your friends, if you meet the, other parents at the kids' soccer games, you're about the same age and you've got kids about the same age and or you meet people at work that you're friends with, you work together. You have things in common with people that you have a good rapport and good connection with. And so one of the first things that I teach someone to do is to be able to, when they're first talking either on the phone with a seller of a property that they want to do a deal with, or certainly in person, to find some things that they could have in common. For example, you mentioned that you were from Chicago. I don't know if I mentioned we were talking before the show here, but I actually grew up in Naperville. So if someone's from Chicago, Naperville is a suburb of that. I will say, hey, yeah, I grew up in Naperville. How about that? Tell me more about you. So that's the formula. You find something. Oh, you've got kids? Awesome. Me too. Tell me more about your kids. And that's the formula for creating rapport very quickly. Location-wise is such an easy one these days. Where are you? You're in San Diego. I've been out there before. It's such a beautiful place. How long have you been there? Really? Amazing. Yeah, where'd you come before? Where were you before that? Oh, that's great. And rapport is kind of one of those things that you just have to practice it everywhere to get really comfortable with it, I think, because I've had people like try and do it, you know, mechanically before. They're like, hello, how are you today? It's like the joke where hello, Mr. Johnson, with 1.5 kids and a wife named Tina. How are you doing today?
Yeah.
So that's step one, is creating some rapport. And the rapport is the beginning process, because people will do deals with you because they like you, they know you, and they trust you. That's the reason they're going to do a deal with you. It's not, yes, it's about the numbers, but it's so much more about how someone feels about you. Do they feel like you're going to take care of them? And do you have their interests in the deal? I mean, it's obviously got to be a good deal for you as an investor too, but are you the type of person that's going to take care of them? And a good connection rapport goes a long way to starting that. And the tip I have for step one rapport is it doesn't end right at step one. You keep rapport going through the whole process. Step number two is what we call an upfront agreement. And an upfront agreement, just to put a big frame around it, is basically a nice way for you to be able to go in and say, hey, I'm happy to sit down and work with you, Mr. Homeowner, to see if we can put something together here. But the one thing that I ask is that at the end of our time, if you absolutely hate the ideas that we come up with together, would you be willing to let me know that? And of course they agree to that. And if they're okay telling you they hate them, then you can say, well, okay, so if you liked them, I mean, if we did have a fit, you'd be okay telling me that too? Sure. Okay, great. I'm going to do the same thing on my end. I'm going to let you know either yes, if there's a way I can help you out and make a profit, I'm willing to move ahead, or no, there's not a way I can see to do that. I'm going to tell you, no, I can't help you. Are you okay if we do it that way here today? And what you're really doing is you're saying, number one, I value my time enough that I'm not willing to chase you around and let you at the end of our time together tell me, oh, it's very interesting, I'm going to think about it and get back to you. Because I found most of the time when someone says that they're going to think about it, they're really not, they're either confused and they're just saying no and they don't want to hurt your feelings, or they don't want to do your deal. And they don't want to say, no, I don't like your deal, go away, right? So I found it's a great time saver for an investor to be able to set this up front agreement right up front, to where when you get at the end, and people will still say this, they'll go, okay, well, yeah, that's interesting. I'm gonna think about it. Okay, well, we had agreed that we weren't going to do that. So I'm just going to, if you tell me you're going to think about it, I'm just going to take that as a no. Oh, no. What is it that you don't like about it? So it allows you to have some clarity in your engagements with people, rather than going out giving like a presentation and having all these people on your list that you're following up with, and you call them and leave a voicemail and they don't call you back. And do you call them back again, or do you email them, or you feel like you're it's horrible to feel like you're chasing somebody. And the upfront agreement helps eliminate that.
So I know there's a little more, but I want to ask on the upfront agreement here. I really love being able to get a commitment or no. I think that like for me and my guys, sometimes there's this fantasy that's comfortable, Peter, and like, yeah, the guy might make an offer or, oh my gosh, the seller's like, they're thinking about, and then they live in the fantasy because they're afraid to hear no and be rejected and have to move on or have to deal with the objection. So they never ask the question in the first place. So this allows you to set that framework up front. How often when you set it up and the person gives you the, oh, I got to think about it. I need another day. And then you remind them of that upfront agreement. Would you say it's like 50-50 that they end up like coming back, you know, engaging and taking and making a deal? Is it like, 10% that they make a deal and 90% that they flake and really mean no? I mean, what's your success rate if you had to guess?
We use two other techniques when we get to the end. One is we call it taking it to no. So what we won't accept is, hey, that's really interesting. I love the idea. This is awesome. You know, you've heard your people come back, right? Yeah, he left. You know, where's the contract? Oh, well, he didn't want to do the contract today. You know, so
yeah.
So I found that if you can be comfortable saying, I just get a sense that it's just not a fit, and that's okay. You know, I've got 20 other people here that I'm supposed to meet with today. And I was thinking there was a reason for me to be here today, but if it's not a fit, I'm perfectly okay with that. And, you know, it's okay. You can just tell me no. And if they fight you on that, say, no, what would make this where it was just an absolute yes, you know, I'm fully on board. I'm going to do this right now kind of thing. And they'll open up and tell you what it is that they don't like or, you know, what's going on. And this isn't where it's like, a high pressure, you must sign now. I'm not going to let you sleep on it or talk to your wife, you know, that kind of thing. It's much more, we need to be clear where we stand. So taking it to no is the one thing technique we use. The other one is, I don't have a name for it, but just a scale of 1 to 10. I'll say, okay, great. So on a scale of 1 to 10 with, one being, you can't wait for me to get out of here. You just hated every bit of this and you can't wait for me to leave. And 10 being is, it's an absolute go. Where are you on that scale of 1 to 10? And I understand you need to, whatever, sleep on it, talk to your wife, whatever, you know, they're telling you. I found if someone doesn't give you an 8 or a 9, that it's a no. If they, you know, 7 sounds like for us optimists, like, oh, they're, you know, it's a go, but 7's not a go. And then when they give you the number, whatever the number is, your next thing to say is, okay, well, what would it take to get you to a 10? And what we're really doing is we're looking for ways to connect and empathize with property owners, whether they own a commercial property or a house, and get them to open up enough to share what's really going on so that we can dig into our toolbox or ideas or creative methods or whatever we have to come up with, hey, here's a way that I could solve that problem for you. But sellers don't want to tell us that, right? Because they know that weakens their position if they let on that they've got a medical situation and they need money or, you know, whatever, or they're going bankrupt or divorce or, I mean, people have all kinds of problems, right? So, and the upfront agreement, I will tell you, is one of the harder steps to really master. I think for the listeners of this podcast, if you can just get in your idea that your time is really valuable and you need to be willing to buy your time enough to say, I'm willing to spend time with you, and in exchange for the time I'm going to spend with you, I'm going to ask that we're clear, you know, after we're done talking today on where we stand.
Why would you say that's a hard step? Do people just avoid it and think it's not important when you're dealing with people and teaching it? Do they, you know, are they afraid to say, like, why is it hard?
It's hard because you're kind of taking charge. You're kind of going in, and instead of saying, hey, let's sit down and let's talk and let's put a deal together, you're saying, it's almost like you're saying, now, wait a minute. I can work with you, but here's the conditions under which I'll work with you. And that's a little uncomfortable for some people. The other thing is, you know, they well, when I teach people the instant operating system, most of them they kind of forget the steps and stuff, which is why I try and script everything out for people and help them with the language patterns. But they'll get to the end and then they'll kind of forget to. They get excited because someone is giving them positive feedback and, oh, that's really interesting. I've never seen something like this before. Gosh, I could see how this would really help us. But they're not getting the deal itself done. So they get excited about maybe having their fish on the line, and then they forget to have this part where they say, okay, well, I'm not really clear on where we stand, and I had told you I wasn't going to take a think it over. In fact, if you tell me think it over, I'm going to take it as a no. So they don't want to take what could maybe be a deal and say this isn't a deal, even though I found that's a very effective way to, number one, figure out whether you have a deal, number two, get the property owner to open up and share with you what's really going on, or, oh, well, I had another offer this morning that I like this about it, or, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that they're not going to tell you necessarily until you
there's almost a willingness to walk away in that moment, and it's very, I think, challenging to walk away from a deal that you, quote-unquote, might get. I mean, you're doing, in a sense, there is a bit of a takeaway close. You're kind of like, hey, you know what,
yeah.
It's not a good fit, that's fine. This is not really... We discussed the upfront agreement. I told you I wasn't going to waste your time. I'm standing here with you right now. I'm like heading out. You know what the environment is out here. Everything's shut down. Like, as you can imagine, Mr. Seller, that my company's receiving a lot of inquiries right now for people that want us to buy their house. Like, I'm happy to do this here with you today. But, you know, like I said up front, we agreed, like, to kind of let each other know if it was not going to be a good fit. So it's sounding like it's not a good fit, maybe.
Exactly right.
So that's step two. Okay.
Yep. The third step is the motivation step. And the motivation is kind of the most critical step. We have a saying that's motivation before money, because money is step four. And everyone always wants to jump to the numbers. In fact, I knocked on the door of a guy's house one time, and he opened the door and he said, okay, what's your deal? And I'm like, whoa, I haven't even seen the house yet. I don't even know, you know, do I want this house? Is this even a good time to be buying a house? You know, playing the role of the reluctant buyer, which you're familiar with. So in the motivation step, our goal is to basically get the owner to tell us all the other options that they have available to them besides working with an investor, and to tell us why none of those other options are going to be a fit, right? And this avoids going through and, hey, we can put this deal together and it's going to be like this and it's going to be great for you. And then they say, oh, well, no, I'm going to list it, or I'm going to do this other thing or whatever. So for someone with a house, what are some of the other things that they could do besides sell it to an investor? What's one of them?
We could rent out the property.
Sure. Sure, you could rent out the property. And the formula we use in the motivation step is basically, so you could rent out the property, which would mean blank. And in that blank, we're going to put a bad thing, but we're going to talk about it like it's a good thing. So if it's renting it out, we would say, oh, that's great. Yeah, you could rent it out. You know, the good thing about that is with you, you know, moving, a 5-hour drive away from here, you're going to get to be able to, you know, enjoy a lot of audiobooks and things in your drive when you have to come out here and deal with tenant issues and stuff. And that's awesome. I mean, most people don't take time to just really, you know, enjoy themselves like that. And you got a nice car that, you know, drives nicely. So that's great that you're going to be able to just handle it all that and be, you know, really enjoying it. And then, of course, that puts them in the position where they can come back and say, oh, what are you talking about? I don't want to deal with that. Or if they, you know, what else have you tried? Well, we listed it with a realtor. Okay. You and I know that if they listed it with a realtor and it worked, that we wouldn't be there as investors, right? So
correct.
Some of these questions you ask are almost, they seem kind of dumb, but when someone is in a situation where they have a problem and they need to solve it and they've been thinking about it day and night, they don't see these questions as dumb. So what else do you hear? Oh, you listed with a real, okay. And that worked out well. And they're saying, no, it didn't work out well. Well, what do you mean? They told you everything they're going to do with the listing appointment and put it on the website and do all the marketing. And they did lots of open houses for you, right? Well, yeah, but it was mostly just the neighbors coming through. And yeah, but I mean, they got you lots of written offers at least, didn't they? No, we didn't get a single offer. What's that? We get hard of hearing when the seller says something that we want the seller to really hear, right? And no, we didn't get anything out of that realtor. What's that? What'd you say? You didn't get what? We didn't get anything from that realtor. Okay, well, maybe if you gave them a second chance and relisted again with that same realtor, I'm sure they would. No, I'm not going to. All right, so maybe someone different from the same. No. Maybe a different brokerage. No, I am not listing the property with a realtor. And that is so much more effective than sitting there saying, you know, we're investors and here's our portfolio and here's what we can do. Here's all the benefits. And you don't have to deal with realtors. Much better to get the other party to tell you why they won't want to use one of the other options available to them. And that's what we do in the motivation stuff. And we're also stirring it up, right? We're stirring up the emotions and just really having fun, you know, digging in. And I discovered a long time ago, if you're going to help someone to move ahead in life, you need to make them realize where they are now and what the effect of doing nothing or staying in the current situation they are. I mean, it's like when you go and see a doctor, the doctor's going to, you've got a wound. He's going to rip the bandage off and go dig around in there and get it cleaned out and, you know, let you know you've really got a serious problem. So you know that you need to take care of it and get it healed up.
There's a thing you alluded to there, and it was like, the hard pitch. So some investors come in and they kind of give the pitch of, oh yeah, Mr. Seller, it's going to be great. We'll handle the clean out. You know, it's going to be an as-is sale. We're going to go to closing in like 14 days. It's going to be no problem and everything's going to be wonderful. And then there's the approach that you kind of just walked through, which to the uninitiated, Peter, it sounds a lot like you're asking stupid, foolish questions that you know the answer to. So we pulled a public record. We looked at Zillow. We know they tried to list it with an agent. And so the inexperienced person saying, why do I have to ask what the options were? I already know what they did. Well, it's not the fact that we're uncovering. It's the emotional journey that must take place to arrive at a place where, you know, the money that we're getting ready to talk about here is palatable, is a viable option, even a good solution. Like, without this emotional journey that we have to guide the seller on, you know, you're sounding a lot like the other non-reluctant buyer, the one that's chasing the deal too hard. This isn't as-is sale. It's clean. It's going to be we buy houses as is.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I feel, I'll tell you just a quick story. There's a house in, it was near Cleveland, Ohio. I was out working with a student. This was many years ago. And yeah, we looked at the house. It was priced, right at about market price. The house was spotless. I mean, this guy had gone through and just spruced everything up. In fact, he was down in the bottom level and he was finishing the inside of a closet down in the basement to give you an idea of the attention to detail that he had given this house as far as getting it ready for sale. And I just went in and looked at the house and I mean, you know, you've seen enough houses where it's, you know, stuff stacked so high you have to turn sideways to get down the hall. And this wasn't one of those. It was a nice place. And I immediately started thinking, you know, there's something going on here. They'd had it on the market for, I think, over a year and it hadn't sold. And he was open to doing something. I said, well, you know, we really probably should sit down with your wife and, you know, I'd like to talk to both of you. And, oh no, she's, you know, I forget what he said, but she's having a hard time right now. Or I'm like, no, I'd like to meet her. And so I met his wife, and she was she came across as very angry in a way that I thought any other investors that tried to buy that thing, either she scared him off, or if they tried to do a deal just with a husband, she killed the deal or whatever. what my intuition was telling me. And we because we were willing to be empathetic and listen to her, and we didn't know right then what was going on, but we knew something was going on. What we discovered later on is that their son had died out back of that house in a irrigation ditch. And she was so tied up emotionally with that, which as well as you could imagine, that house was just, I don't know what to compare it to, maybe an anchor dragging her down, or just where she was just stuck. She was just stuck there. And we put a deal together on that house. It was a lease purchase deal. And, you know, it was a good deal for us. I think it was a good deal for them too, because it allowed her to finally be able to close that door and hopefully start to heal emotionally and move on. And so you just never know what someone's going through. You know, we think of ourselves sometimes, or I think other people do, they think of us as investors as, you know, just the Sharpie real estate investors that out to make a buck. Well, there's a lot more to it than that. So that's the power of being willing to really dig in and connect emotionally and find out what's going on with, you know, with the seller. One of my mentors years ago, he said, well, we just want all cash. Okay. So what are you going to do with that? Well, we don't know. Okay. Well, so if I paid you all cash and it was just sitting here on the table, if I came back here 2 weeks later, it would still be a pile of cash. Oh, no. Where would it go? What are you going to do with it? Let's see if we can find a way to get you that same result. We did a deal on a house in, was in the hills east of San Diego, $600,000 house owned by a realtor himself who had been trying to sell it. And, he said, well, I'm just going to take the money and put it in a bank account and get, I think it was 5% he could get back then. I get 5% interest on it. I've got my place already bought down in Sunnyside Acres or wherever he was retiring to. And we said, okay, well, that's great. If, you know, if we could find a way to get you that same thing, would that be worth us spending any time talking about? Or you probably hate the idea, huh? Using some negative phrasing there, because we know that people, when they're stressed, they're going to tend to disagree with us. So we make it where when they disagree, it's like they're saying yes. That's what negative phrasing does. So if there's a way we could get you that same result. Now, notice I'm not saying, well, we could do an owner carry loan with blah, 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 and have a, you know, interest rate and balloon. I'm using very plain language describing what they could get out of it. If there's a way we could get you that same result, maybe in a little bit of a different way, is that even worth us taking time to talk about? Or you probably hate the idea, huh? No, tell me more about that. We put together a deal. He did need a little down payment. But we put together a deal where he carried the financing at 6%. And we had that place for, I forget, 5 or 6 years, bought it for 600 and sold it for nine something. So,
wow.
So nice, you know, nice deal. No banks involved. That's the way I like it.
Good deal.
Okay. So step number four is the money step. And our saying that we have, and I'll mention it again, is motivation before money. So if you find yourself talking numbers or getting into the details of the deal before you've really dug in and found out what the seller's motivation is. And I think the mistake most people make motivation-wise is they'll ask them, okay, well, why are you selling? Oh, well, because whatever. My daughter moved and to a different state, and we're going to move to be closer to her. That might be the reason, but it's probably, if they're motivated way we need them to be to do a deal. There's probably something else going on in addition to that, or that's much, much more of an issue for them than that. So sometimes it's just a matter of going back and asking and poking and prodding and finding out what that motivation is. During the money step, we want to get clear on all of the financial details about the property. We want to soften them up on their price, both as far as the value that they want to get for the house, and if we're going to be coming in and cover their payments or any of that type of stuff. We want to soften them up a bit on that. I insist on knowing how much they owe against the property and what their current payments are. And sometimes I'll be working with a student and they'll say, oh, well, they wouldn't tell me that. Well, that's a pretty good indication to me that you probably don't have a good rapport and a good connection. Number one. Number two, if someone says at that point in the conversation, well, why should I tell you that? I'm going to say, well, because I'm here to help you out and I need to know all that information if I'm going to help you out. If you're not willing to share that, then, I don't mean to be rude, but I've got 15 other houses to go look at today. And I just had a sense. I felt a sense that maybe I should be here to see if there's a way that I could help you out and put something together here today. Maybe I was wrong. I don't know. Oh, no. We owe X amount. Right. So. So during the money step, a couple of things that we found has just been very, very effective. We call them the three R's. The first R stands for realistically. The second R stands for range. And the third R stands for realtor. And I love realtors. I love brokers. I've made a lot of money with them, both buying and selling over the years. You guys are awesome. So don't be offended that we're going to bring you into the equation here to get the price down a little bit. So when you had mentioned before about asking like a dumb question that you already know. Here's one of those right now. What was it? Could you tell me what was it again that you were asking for the property? I mean, you know what that is, right? It's probably right on the flyer.
Yeah,
on the kitchen table or whatever. What was it? And we have a saying that dumb gets paid. So if you were a seller, would you feel more comfortable selling your house to like a real super sharp real estate investor that had answers to everything and knew everything and told you everything to do, or someone that was maybe a little bit slower than you?
Smart.
So we use this idea to help the seller. I mean, their life's out of control, right? We're going to give them the feeling of comfort that they have some control over what's going on by letting them be smarter, sharper. If there's any math to do, we're going to let them do the math. If it's early in the morning, it's, oh gosh, I hadn't had my coffee yet. I'm having a hard time. Can you help me with this? If it's later in the day, it's, oh, it's been a long day. What was it again you were asking for the property? $250,000. Okay. And now when I respond, notice what happens to the tone of my voice when I say the word realistically. So what was it you were asking for the property again? $250,000. Okay. And what did you realistically expect to get? So when we say that, your tone of voice goes down, which means that the price goes where?
Down.
And isn't it true that anybody, whether they're selling something on Craigslist or a house or a car or anything, don't they list it for, you know, don't they put a price that's higher than they realistically expect to get? That's
always.
That's the mindset that we have when we say that. What did you realistically expect to get? Well, $240. Okay, so $220 to $240, somewhere in there. I've just gone to the second R, which is range, and we've given them a range of $220 to $240. If they fight you on it, no, I said $240. Oh, okay, I understand. $230, $240, somewhere in there. And you just, when you do that, you look at them and you kind of nod your head up and down a little bit. You say, okay, $230, $240. It's just like you've got the body language that they're agreeing with you when you say that. And at the point, you keep shrinking the range until they stop fighting with you. When they stop fighting you with you in a, you know, in a tight market, you might have to get up to, okay, so 236, 240, somewhere in there. And these, you know, these don't work like magic, but these three R's really have, I've had people come back and say, you made me $10,000 just doing that thing. So this is great stuff. So, we're going to use the range, whatever number they stop fighting us at. If they stop fighting us, say at this is going to make the math hard, but that's okay. Say they stop fighting us at, if I said 240, 250, and they said, yeah. Or if I said 235, 240, and I said, okay, well, let's say I got them down to 235, 240, and they said, yeah, somewhere in there. That means they just agreed pretty much to 235. Now we're going to bring our third R in, which is realtor. And the language we use is critical here. We're going to say, Mr. Mrs. Seller, if you had a realtor that showed up and told you they could have this thing handled, you know, completely done and sold within 30 days, bring you a buyer at that 235 price, you'd probably tell them to go take a hike, huh? Now, we didn't say if a realtor brings you a buyer. We've said if a realtor came in and said, hey, I can have this whole thing completely handled for you, I'll have it done, sold within 30 days, at that 235 price, you'd probably tell them to go take a hike, huh? And when they say, no, we would do that, they've just agreed to what kind of a discount off that 235 price?
It's got to be 6%, right?
Yep. And then we let them do the math because we're not good at math, or, you know, I can't figure it out here. Help me figure it out. Let's see, 10% of 235, that would be 23. How much is that? 20. And we kind of go through it like that, letting them fill in the numbers. So, you know, if you have 235 and you can say, okay, so 10% of that is how much? And, you know, let them give you the numbers. And then half of that would be 5, and that's okay. And you just be comfortable with the silence. Just sit there and wait for the seller to give you the numbers. If they want to do the math, or they hand you a calculator, to, you know, hand it back to them and say, gosh, I don't know how to operate one of those. Why don't you do it? It's a little harder to do that now these days, I guess, with everyone has a calculator on their phone, but,
yeah, they do.
So great. So let's see, whatever the number turns out to be, let's see, that would be 12, 13, say it's 13,000. I could be off on the math. 13. So 13,000 from 235. Let's see. That would be 225 would be 10. And then, so you just really go through it slow like that and let them tell you what it is. And that's the number that you write down if you have like a sheet of paper there. By the way, I don't go in with contracts I don't even go in with a pen or a pencil. And when I first learned from one of my mentors years ago to do that, it sounded just crazy to not do that. I think I brought like a pad of paper inside maybe a briefcase or something at first, but I realized that if you can show up on the door to talk to someone about buying their house, and you're not holding a slide projector or a computer with a PowerPoint presentation or anything like that, you look a lot more like a friend, don't you? You just show up with nothing, like, hey, I just came over to, you know, see the house, and who knows, maybe we'll put something together. You want to show me around? So yeah, that's the number that we write down, is because the number doesn't really have any validity until it's written down. And through those three R's, I guarantee for those of you listening to the show, when you apply them, they don't always work, but those three R's will make you a ton of money over time. And so now nice. We're going to move into our final step, which we call the what if step. And the fun thing about the what if step is allows us to basically put together a creative offer to buy a house and basically find out if the property owner is going to agree to the idea before we ever officially make our offer. It reminds me of like when we were in middle school and you would ask someone to say, hey, you know, would you ask Shelly over there if I asked her out to be mine or go with me or whatever we called it back then? Would she say yes or not, you know, to find out before you ask. So the key with this is to use language that is not technical. It's not, and the language that I use, we could go from this language, we could go to a commercial master lease. If it was a commercial property, we could go to owner carry financing paperwork wise. We could go to maybe buying it subject to the existing financing. That's just all the paperwork. What we're doing is we're figuring out what from the seller's end, what do they need to have this be a win for them? And what it sounds like is, gosh, you know, you've told me about all this other stuff you've tried, and we sigh a lot as reluctant buyers, right? I'm not sure we could do anything or not, but you know, what worked out in another situation like this is, and you can say if you've done it or for someone who hasn't done one of these before, you could say, I know of another investor. What they did is they came in and they basically agreed to pay that monthly payment of, monthly payment of $1,800 a month. And I'm not sure we could go that high. My partner's probably going to say we should only pay, you know, 16 or 17, but let's say we could go as much as that 1800 a month. And, you know, we'd come in, we'd pay you that over a period of time. And at some point down the line, we'd come up with a way to cash you out of the property. Is that something that is even worth us spending any time talking about, or you probably hate the idea, huh? Very much negative phrasing. We know they're going to want to disagree. When they come back, now here's the critical key with the what if step. When they come back and say, yeah, that would be exactly what I want, the new investor jumps into sales mode and goes, wow, that's great. Let me tell you about it. It's called a commercial master lease, and here's why it's the greatest thing for you. And we're going to take care of all the repairs, and we're going to guarantee the payments, and don't you worry, we're going to get this place cleaned up and turned around, and so you have to stay reluctant. And so the way we do that is when they say, yeah, that is something I'd like to talk about. We pick out one of the benefits in there, and we turn it around into this, oh, okay, I understand you want to talk about that. I'm curious, what is it about? And we're going to push on whatever we know their biggest button is. So if they've had major tenant issues or, they're concerned about, you know, making the mortgage payment, maybe they're moving out of a house and they're going to have double payments, whatever we know their main issue is, we're going to pick that main issue and we're going to say, I'm curious, what is it about, you know, having that payment covered? What is there about that even makes us worth spending time to figure out together? Well, because if you could cover my payment, then I couldn't go ahead and move, and I blah blah blah, and that's why it's, you know, that's why it's good for me. And then we don't just accept that right away. We'll spend time and dig in and you know, tell me more about that and why is it important to you, and are you sure that's, you know, are you sure that that's something that would be a fit for you? And we don't have any paperwork out. We haven't said what kind of a deal it is. We're getting them to, I have a theory that's called the seven yeses. And most people can't do this, but I will sit there and I will just keep engaging the seller to say, well, yeah, but I mean, probably, you know, what's some language I use? So yeah, we want that. Yeah, but, I mean, who knows the market, the market might take off. Who knows? I mean, once things settle down here, the market takes off. I mean, values could go up again, and then you'd probably wish that you, you know, did a different route and you waited rather than doing something like this. No, I want to do, we're getting the seller to tell us, yes, I will do this. Generally we'll put kind of a timeline sort of thing on it and say, well, was this something you wanted to have happen, you know, sooner? Or, I mean, if it took 6 months, a year, 2 years to get things solved, is that, I get a sense that'd be okay for you, wouldn't it? No, I'm not. 2 years, you're crazy. I need this thing done right away. Okay, so if it was 6 months, no, I can't. I need it done now. Oh, okay, so, well, I guess this is worth us trying to figure out together. So we'll basically get the seller to give us the components of the deal we're putting together and struggle through it with them together and fight them on everything, being the reluctant buyer. Okay, so, gosh, it's been a long day again. I'm sorry. So with the price, you said the price would be $225 to $230. No, I told you $235. Oh, that's right. You told me $230, $235. We're throwing the range technique back in there again. And then that payment of, I know you want the $1,800. My partner's, he's going to say like $1,500, $1,600 maybe. But you want that much? $1,800? I gotta have $1,800. Okay, let's say we could do it for $1,800. We'd have to figure out how long we're gonna go. And this is a big mistake people make with creative deals. They'll ask the seller without putting this framing language in front of it that I'm gonna share with you in a moment here. They'll ask the seller, how long would you go if we were doing a commercial master lease on an apartment building. And the answer for the seller is what? You know, 3 months, right? Or, you know, a year, something like that, maybe. And then if you start at a year, you're trying to negotiate them up to 5 or 10 years, which is where I typically get these things negotiated to. It's a hard slog to get from 1 year up to 10 years. What we found is when you use this language, you say, we'd have to figure out how long of a term. My partner's going to want to go a medium length of time. We put a label on that. My partner's going to go to a medium length of time of 5 to 7 years, and he may even want to go longer than that. What's the longest you could go, keeping in mind that the longer we go, the closer we could come to that, you know, $230, $235 price that we talked about? And so when you framed it that way, typically they're coming back and saying, you know, some people say, oh, I don't know, I guess I could go 5 years. But, you know, people, they might say, oh, gosh, 3, 4 years maybe. But then at least you're starting at 4 years, and then there's ways that you can negotiate them up from there to go longer. With a creative deal, what you're doing is you're not fighting them on price like, you know, so many people wholesaling houses and I buy cash do. You're working the other side of the equation. I learned from my very first mentor, he said, Peter, you can have your price or you can have your terms, but you can't have both. So if you can get great terms and buy a property without having to put much of your own money in it, or maybe just the money to fix it up, not have to go out and get a new loan, and you have a deal on that property that's good for, you know, 5, 6, 8, 10 years, the longer the better. The longer a creative deal is put together, the more sure you are that you're going to make a profit in that. Because we can't predict, like right now with everything that's going on, we can't predict what's going to happen over the next couple of months or even probably the next year. But we know if we look at a nice piece of property in a decent area, we know, and I feel confident, that 10 years from now, that property is going to be worth quite a bit more than it is right now today.
A ton of solid gold there. I want to underline and point out for anyone listening that your tonality and your pauses and the slowness and the tempo, all of that was like very, very intentional and designed throughout that entire process. It wasn't like you were literally scratching for what you said to the seller. That's what you're doing in the presence of the seller to get the result that you're looking for. I think it was a it's important to remember that, and it's like really worth for people to kind of like go back and listen to that one again, because that stuff was solid gold throughout. And you're doing this not just – one of the things you just mentioned here, Peter, which I think is a very interesting takeaway. Back in 2007, I read the book, and as you were talking, I remember doing all this stuff on these terms deals, and I ran out and I signed up like 4 or 5 or some like ridiculous number of like mortgage takeover subject to deals, using the language. It was happening so often that like some of them, I had to like cancel them. Like, oh, I don't even want this thing anymore. It's like, it was like magic to see it start to work. But, the nice piece of property in a decent area as an investment philosophy. So like over your, you know, 1990 to 2020. So it's like 30 years, experience of investing. Can you talk about maybe if there was a transition, maybe you always started with looking for somewhat desirable properties in desirable areas. Maybe that desirable property became larger multifamily, larger commercial, so that was more bang for your buck in the time you were investing. But could you maybe like talk about your revelations when it came to like the properties and the types of deals that you were trying to work on, certainly, you know, toward the height of what you were up to?
Yeah. Well, I think with commercial properties, like with the I'm putting together a small group of people right now to go out and do commercial lease options together. And what I'm teaching them is you need to start out in more of the C-class areas. For someone not familiar with commercial properties, is C-class. A-class is new, you know, 10 years or built 10 years ago or newer. B is 20 years or newer. This is, you know, quick picture. C-class is, you know, built 30 years ago. Working class neighborhoods. And when I went into some of these neighborhoods when I was first investing, it seemed kind of out of my element. It seemed like this is a safe neighborhood to me. But what I found was when you pick these neighborhoods where you don't want a war zone, you don't want, you know, gangs and gunfire and stuff like that. But there's people that live in these areas that they've lived there all their life. Their relatives live on that street. They work right down the street. They know the area. That is home to them. And to be able to find an area like that to get started in, I think is very helpful, you know, especially with commercial, because those properties, especially the smaller ones, you know, 5 units to up to maybe 50 units, that's an area where it's more, you know, mom and pop owners. It's not a real estate investment trust that owns the property. It's a real person that has real problems that you can find somebody that's going, you know, they're going through. I did a 12-unit property. They were getting divorced. I got them to bring $10,000 to the closing to pay me to take over the property. So I think starting there with commercial is, you know, makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, the problem is these days with the internet and all this stuff and all the gurus and stuff out there, they have these whatever. You know, hey, I'll show you to go how to go buy 1,000 units in a year. I'll tell you how to go buy a 200 unit property if you've never done it before. That, you know, that sounds really good in a webinar or on a sales page or something, but in actual practice, to go without the confidence of having done deals before and try and convince someone that you've got what it takes to solve their problem and take care of their property is very difficult to do. So I believe in taking baby steps and getting started with some smaller deals at first. Now, the nice thing about doing creative stuff on houses is you can do nice homes in nice areas with creative transactions, although you're not going to buy the house that was just listed 2 weeks ago that everything's spruced up and it looks like, you know, Better Homes and Gardens. Generally, there's something going on, either a situation or problem with the owner. There's railroad tracks out back, or there's the house just needs paint and carpet and cleaned and spruced up. I mean, houses get worn down slowly, so people don't notice it over the 20 or 30 or 40 years they live there. And so, you know, those are the houses that we like to find, are ones that really don't need much of anything besides just a little paint and cleanup. But you're probably not going to do a deal like on the, you know, the mansion up on the hill kind of thing. Although that happens too, but just for general practice. I don't know how well I answered your question there.
Yeah, it did, because I think where I screwed up on the three or four I signed up, and I think I kept one or something, and I didn't make that my entire business model. The creative, we're kind of more like the, all right, we're fighting on price, we're buying it, we're doing a renovation, we're reselling it. Maybe there's times we're wholesaling the deal because it's not in our prime neighborhood, price point model, timing with the contractors, whatever. But, you know, as I do the math on the ones that I walked away from, a big part of the issue was these were kind of, you know, they're like rental properties in like $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 areas, like kind of low end properties where the rents were even low. So like the numbers are almost right. So small, it's not worth the effort. Whereas if I take a property in Smyrna, Georgia, that's $400,000, and we're taking over, you know, mortgage payment at, you know, $365, and there's a way for the market rents, the lease option sandwich, whatever, for me to sell that at $400,000 or $440,000, suddenly there's maybe some upside there of $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 there. Whereas I'm going to be like, you know, impossibly pressed to turn my $50,000, $60,000 lease option and like sell it for, you know, 70, 80, even, like there's not even room to get through inspections or do a paint and carpet if it's needed in there. So it's like, you know, finding the right single families. But yeah, you did.
I would agree with that. Yeah, I would agree with that if you're down too far down the ladder, I guess it's different with commercial properties. And, you know, with commercial properties, one of the things I learned is that you can get some of these older properties, and I made the mistake of trying to fix them up too much because I thought, well, I'll fix it up really super nice and then people will pay another $75 a month in rent just because it's nicer, not because of what the rents are in the area. And what I found is $75 is a lot to someone who's paying, you know, $1,400 a month. My goal has always been to provide, you know, clean, safe, affordable housing that's better. It's a better product than anything else in that neighborhood. So if someone's looking to rent some in that neighborhood and they go around and look at four or five properties, I want mine to be clean and smell good and painted and you know, everything works. And it's not going to be probably a deluxe house like many of us in, you know, superstar investors live in or whatever, you know. But it's, you know, it's a nice home for people to live in, and you know, they pay the rent every month working hard, and it's a big part of their income, and they're paying down your mortgage every month. They do that, and thank goodness for people like that. That's what makes real estate work, for the people who are willing to take an idea like this or even listen to a you know, crazy podcast like this and say, hey, I'm going to jump into this. I've been thinking all my life I need to do something like this. Now's the time I'm going to do it.
So we have a lot of single family investors. That's kind of my thing, residential. And we have a lot of people who come on the show, you know, own thousands of units of multifamily, the old fashioned way, raising money, syndicating, et cetera. Maybe a quick story from, you know, we don't have to go into all the details of it, but I don't know, something that might be like a good bridge deal where you'd use a lease option to buy, I don't know, an 8, a 10, a 20 unit apartment building. Do you happen to have any of those kind of like, you know, deals that you were done or a part of that you could like quick share kind of numbers and details of how that deal went down, just to highlight the power of maybe a master lease option terms deal on a commercial property?
Sure. Yeah, there was an apartment building that I picked up, 24 units. It was, it came to me through one of my relationships with a commercial broker, where he had tracked down the owner. He had tried to list it, but they didn't want to sell it because it was fully depreciated. And they realized that if they waited until the owner, who was 88 years old at that time and had Alzheimer's, these are her daughter and her son-in-law that I was talking with, they realized that because of the tax laws, if they waited until the owner passed on, it would move up to market value and they would save like a couple $100,000 in taxes that they wouldn't pay. And so they didn't want to list it. And the the broker said, here, you know, I can't do anything with this. Why don't you, he didn't have an idea what I did, but he said, why don't you see if you can do something with your, you know, whatever methods you use. And I met with him and took a look at it. So their problem was, remember we talked earlier about finding out what the real problem is. The problem was they needed $3,000 a month to pay for her nursing home care. The property was free and clear. It was only generating $2,000 a month. I found out a big reason it was only generating $2,000 a month is because the property management companies have been really soaking them for fees and stuff over the past couple of years to the tune of about $1,000 a month. So I looked at it and realized, shoot, I can manage this thing myself for a while to get, you know, going and turned around. So I can get that $3,000 a month out of the property. I managed to meet them out at the property on a day when there was an issue with the boiler in the boiler room. You know, the dark, like, you know, spider webs and a dim light bulb. And there's like a foot and a half of black water on the floor. And the guy standing there in his dark blue suit, the guys that charge, you know, whatever, 150, 200 bucks an hour overtime on the weekends. He's sitting there looking at it, and the bubbles coming up, coming up from the floor, you know, whatever, the piping under there. And that's, I mean, it looks like a nightmare, right? It's not a nightmare. It's, you know, it's like whatever, $10,000 or $15,000. It's not a problem, right? So, but it was good to meet. It's like negotiating on the house. One of my students did a deal. He met the seller out back by the smelly dumpsters where he put the field. So what we agreed to do was to pay $3,000 a month, and we agreed even to pay the, this is quite a few years ago, was $450,000 was what the broker was going to list it for. And then the other thing that I haven't mentioned yet is that the rents were low, which is why with what we're doing right now is, we're basically putting lists of commercial properties together, and then we're going out and doing research to find out what the rents are on every single property in a market area. And then we're focusing rifle shot wise rather than shotgun wise on those properties with below market rents. So
nice.
Basically put together a commercial master lease, $3,000 a month. The purchase price was $450,000. The time period was when she died, then we could exercise our option. And that was the deal I put together. And I took that deal to one of my mentors at the time and said, hey, I put this deal together. I just want to see what you thought. And he said, that's an amazing deal. That's awesome. And I said, well, how can I make it better? So the only way you can make it better would be if you got them to carry the financing after you bought it. So I went back to him and I said, you know, I like this deal. Okay. It's, you know, I've got some concerns about this and that. And, I just wanted to see if you could possibly carry the financing, you know, after I buy it. And so they agreed to carry the financing for 30 years after I bought it and, put the deal together. And then, it's kind of a long story because they tried to fight me on it, which that's one of the things I've learned over the years is how to secure your interest in creative deals like this, which is a whole nother day of another podcast or something sometime, which we figured out how to do that over the years. So we went in. They're all on month-to-month rents, which is great. We didn't want them to all move out en masse, so we did eight the first month, eight the second month, and eight the third month. We filled out this one-page form that I came up with that said, hey, you know, isn't it great you've been living here with low rents? You know, sorry, that time's up. Your rent's going up. We weren't even raising it all the way to market. We were taking it about 75% of the way up to market. And in exchange for, we want you to know we value you as a resident. We'll be willing to paint any one of your rooms, clean your carpets, or give you the services of our handy person for half a day. That's all stuff we're going to do anyways. We might as well give it to them as a gift, right? About half of them each month said, screw you. I don't know who you think. I've been paying this for whatever, 10 years. I'm not paying a penny more. Great. Let me open the door. Get your stuff out of here. It just makes it that much easier for us to clean it up, turn it around, and rent it full market rent.
Nice.
So over 3 months, we were able to increase the income. We reduced some of the expenses and stuff. We do things like getting a smaller dumpster instead of the big one that everyone up and down the alley dumps all their stuff in and getting it picked up more often, stuff like that. We were able to increase the net income by an average of $85 per unit, which with 24 units is $2,000. I could be a little bit off the map. I think $2,025, something like that, a month. Which, remember, the property was break even when I took it over. I was taking what the property was making, $3,000 a month because of $1,000 in property management fees. I was doing that. I was taking that whole $3,000, getting it to the owner. Then we increased that by a couple thousand. So now we've got this property that's making an extra $24,000 a year. And when you apply a six cap to that, then we weren't six caps back then, but I'll just do the math.
Might not be soon.
You know, with a six cap, that's an increase of value of $400,000.
Yeah.
So, that property, you know, that was a nice enough deal. It was a nice enough area. I said, I'm just going to keep this one. I managed it myself for the first, I don't know, 5 or 6 months. And then I actually turned it over to an employee of mine who I helped to create her own property management company because I didn't want to be doing that. And she managed it for quite a few years for me. And I ended up owning it for, I think it was 15, 16 years. And the point in time when I sold it, I had, the other part of it, they had tried to fight me and defeat my interest in the property. And they lost. They ended up paying my attorney's fees on that. But one of the things I gave them in return for settling that was I said, I'll let go of the 30-year owner care financing part. I'll get new financing and bring it in if you agree to sell it to me at the price you agree. And that's what we did. And it was cash flowing pretty good. So I ended up putting a 10-year amortized note on it to just pay that baby down as quickly as I could. And so by the point in time when I sold it, it was pretty much paid off, and I sold it for a little less than $1.2 million.
So about how much cash did you put in up front on that, Peter? Because, like, right there when you took it over, there's like a, you know, you must have actually had to put some real dollars to work here to turn this thing around, right?
You would think so, which is why I hesitate to tell this story because it sounds unbelievable. I arranged to have my first payment due on the 15th. I collected the rents it was October 1st when I took it over. Collected the rents. Out of the rents I collected, I came up with a $3,000 to pay the first payment. And I basically used the cash flow from the property. I mean, there were a few things that broke here and there that maybe I had to come out of pocket for, you know, a couple $1,000, whatever. There's a leak like under the cement that they have to come in and use their sensors to find out where it is and stuff. But pretty much just used the cash flow from the property over the years to keep it going. And I the only thing I did, I guess I put a roof on it. It was about $20,000 to replace the roof. So, but even that, I think I had the money in the bank by that time from the property. But either way, I wasn't digging deep in my pocket to say, okay, I'm investing all this money and waiting for it to come out. And
did you do the roof before or after the court battle on the, you know, option challenge from the previous owner? Was that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So.
Gotcha.
You know, it was basically a nothing down deal that I ended up making over $1 million on. And, you know, they don't all turn out that way. That's the other reason I hesitate to tell that story because, you know, someone wants to go out and do that deal, their very first one.
That's all I want to do.
I'll take three of those, you know. What I
you
found is that the way you do home run deals is you get out and you hit some singles and you strike out a few times and the cool thing with the creative investing, at least the way I structure stuff and put it together, which is why we're kind of focusing on that right now with all the uncertainty that's going on in the marketplace right now, is that worst case in most of these deals you've lost some of your time. You put a deal together, you don't have any money to speak of into it up front. Maybe you've got inspection or environmental review or, you know, a little bit of money like that. But worst case, the deals that I put together are structured where if, who knows, you know, a dirty bomb goes off or the, you know, something happens where the the owner had PCBs out back and didn't tell you about it. The deals I structure, you have the ability to basically take that property and give it back to the owner and just say, hey, I didn't plan this. I didn't want it, but I'm not able to continue on this. Here's your property back. And that's,
that makes that peace of mind
to be able to, you know, at the end of the week, to be able to go to bed at night and know that, you're investing, but you're not. I always tell people, look, you worked really hard to get to where you are now. The last thing you want to do is go out and do a deal that's going to risk what you've built up to where you are today. You want to be able to do something that has the upside with very little to no, and preferably no downside.
True enough. True enough. I couldn't agree more. So, Peter, let's, as we're turning the corner here toward the end of the episode a little bit, I know from our previous conversations that you had kind of a tragedy that maybe shifted a lot of things over the last decade. Do you mind sharing some of that with the audience here?
Sure. It's funny that you say it as a tragedy. My wife has said if you could change that one day in your life, would you change it? And I don't know that I would. 7 years ago, I was riding a dirt bike motorcycle, which my wife, she I should have listened to her. What can I say? She said, shouldn't be doing that. You're in your 50s. You're going to get hurt. No, I'll be fine. I'm just going to go trail riding. And so the problem is where I live, it's about an hour and a half to, get the bike somewhere where you can ride around some guy's farm. And I found this Hair Scrambles race in New Jersey. And I had promised my wife I was not going to race. I will admit that. Luckily, she's a forgiving soul. So I figured I would just go there and let everyone else go ahead of me and then just treat it kind of like an organized trail ride and have a good time. And so I did that. I let my group go ahead, but then there were these other faster guys that had started before us that started, it was like an 11-mile loop through the woods. These guys started passing me and my old competitive spirit started kicking in. I thought, I can keep up with that guy. I can keep up with that guy. And then before I knew it, I clipped a tree and did the whole helicopter ride and shattered my hip, dislocated my femur, and then when they were working on me in the hospital, they crushed the nerve in my leg. And wow, you talk about something hurting. That really tickled bad. So I was in intensive care and I was in rehab center for a month and came home in a hospital bed for a couple months and then I was in a wheelchair and then a walker and then crutches and then a cane. And so during that process, I sold off a bunch of my real estate. I sold off my education company. I had 35 employees, 17 coaches at one point. And I said, I just need to focus on getting better. So sold that to a partner of mine, just focusing on trying to get better. And the funny thing about a nerve injury like that is if you just sit around, it gets worse. It like tightens up and hurts more and then you want to do less and it just gets worse and worse. And so, I realized that I needed to do something different. And I've always believed that no matter what your challenge is, you don't necessarily need to know how to solve that challenge, but you do need to know how to ask good questions. If you can ask the right questions, you're going to find the right answer. So I wrote in my journal, I wrote this question down. It was, how could I turn this injury into an advantage to where it's a fun challenge and I had other people cheering me on, is what I wrote in my journal. And then a couple weeks later, we saw this movie Wild with Reese Witherspoon's character where she hikes the Pacific Crest Trail on the West Coast, which is, over a couple thousand miles. And then I read some books about people hiking the Appalachian Trail, which goes from Georgia to Maine, 2,190 miles. And I thought, if I hiked over 2,000 miles, my leg would have to be better. And this is at a point in time where I was having a hard time getting out to walk the dog. So I tell my wife, I say, honey, I'm thinking of hiking the Appalachian Trail. She's like, oh, that's nice, dear. And then 3 weeks later, she took me to the train station, dropped me off. I took the train down and started in. The first day I went 2.5 miles and kind of went from there. I mean, it took me a total of 11 months spread over a year and a half to do the whole thing. It takes most people 4 or 5 months. Most years, this year, there's people that had to stop, which was unfortunate, but what an incredible experience, just from the whole, like, breaking stuff down into little chunks. If I thought about how far I had to go, I would fail. Like, mentally, I could not keep going. What I had to do was I had to think about, okay, I've only got 2 days to get to the next point where I can stop at a hostel, or, you know, I actually end up bringing my car along. I parked my car a couple days ahead, shuttled down, hiked to my car, and then I had my car. I could go drive, go get a steak dinner, go walk in a pool, which is my leg, go to a nice Airbnb, nice. Go to the Outfitters. And so, you know, there are times when I would have to look up ahead and say, okay, all I'm going to do is I'm going to get to that tree up there that's like 100 yards away. That's all I'm going to focus on. And so that breaking stuff down into just the tiny chunks was a huge thing. And the other thing was hiking along. I finally had time to, like, really process and, you know, listen to the birds and the wind through the trees and realize how blessed I've been in my life and all the wonderful, cute little things my kids did over the years that I'd forgotten about. And I realized I'd created this big, you know, teaching and thousands of students and stuff. And, you know, I'd go to our annual conference and there'd be a guy coming up and shaking my hand saying, Peter, thanks so much. You changed my life. I bought a 200 unit, blah, blah, blah. I did this and that. And it just felt so, I didn't know this. I didn't know the guy's name, right? I mean, yeah, he used my system and, you know, worked with our coaches and stuff, but I didn't know who he was. It felt to me like, how can that possibly be true? Here's this guy. He knows me. Well, he knows me because he's listened to my voice and videos and, you know, everything, right? He knows me all really well, but I don't know him. And when I was hiking along, I realized that the point that I enjoyed the most over the years was when I was doing the mentoring myself and teaching people directly myself and helping people over that, you know, through the scary part of, like, in the beginning of, you know, you're just putting a deal together and, oh my goodness, is it going to work out? And am I going to fail? And what are people going to think? And can I possibly do this? I just get such a thrill over helping someone through that hard part to get going. I did a deal with a student about a year ago. We found a 16,000 square foot commercial property in Northern California, picked it up for $810,000. He's taken about a year to get it fully leased up. A couple of those are on hold right now with the whole coronavirus thing, but basically has it leased up and is worth $2.2 million. And he wow. told me later, he said, I was scared to death. He said he wouldn't have been able to do it, but I kept telling him, this is a great deal. You know, I've seen lots of deals. This is a great deal. You need to move on this one. Oh, and I helped him line up a money guy to come in, give him all the money to buy it and fix it up, and no payments for the first year. So what I realized was that I was going to do things different afterwards. I was going to basically, you know, I was blessed to be at a point where I had all the time, all the money, all the opportunity. I could do whatever I wanted to at this point in my life. And, I said, I'm just going to work with a handful of people for a couple of years, which I did the past couple of years and had pretty, you know, pretty high fees. I was getting $25,000 plus half the first $200,000 in profits on commercial properties. And so lately I've decided to put together a group, going after really the best parts of commercial real estate, doing commercial lease options where we, you know, we're looking to acquire properties using either commercial master lease, owner care financing, or subject to, there's 8 profit activators that we go through to look at things, you know, raising the rents is one of my favorites, adding coin laundry, things like that, to where you can either implement those or you can just take a property that has the ability to have the net operating income increased and document that carefully in a package that we put together for investors, to where we can take that package and say, here's the deal. We've already got creative financing in place. Here's the upside. Here's when you do all these things, put a little capital into it. Here's how much it's going to be worth. And then we use a contract assignment to basically get a nice fee to get a chunk of money and be out of the deal. Or, you know, if it's a decent deal and nice property, a nice area, keep it yourself, or bring an investor in to give you some money for a chunk of it so you can make a little money up front and give them some equity. And I've, in my 30 years of investing, I've never seen a better time than right now to be getting out doing any type of real estate, whether it's the commercial lease options or someone going after houses or whatever you're doing. If you're listening to this podcast, you've been waiting for the right time. right now is I think the very best time to get out there with just all the uncertainty out there. Yeah, there's a few more things you need to be careful about right now. One of which is, when are people going to start paying their rent again? But
yeah, true enough.
We're gonna work our way through this. We're a great country. We will work our way through this, and we will come out of it, I think, stronger. I think things are going to change. That, you know, companies that are learning right now that they can all work virtually and they don't need to all be in an office building, once they get used to doing that, they're gonna realize we don't need to be paying for this office building every year. And I think there's going to be a lot of change. I think that houses and apartments, there's going to be less changes than in other parts of commercial real estate. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, I agree there. So do you have any books you recommend to the people who are your, you know, coaching students or just people in general over the years having to do with business or real estate, Peter?
Yeah, there's a couple that little known books. There's one called Instant Rapport by Michael Brooks. It's still available on, last I looked on Amazon, a little paperback, and it goes through. He actually gets into eye movements and stuff like that I don't bother with rapport-wise. It's a little too deep, but it's the best book I found that really helps to get the whole rapport and creating similarities. And best I ever hit it was because you want to dress like the person you're meeting with, right? Similar clothes. I was wearing the exact same shirt as a guy that owned an apartment building that I was trying to buy one time. So nice. I don't know how I did that. The other book is called The Portable Coach. It's by Thomas Leonard. He's since passed away, but great guy. And just he's more in like the whole personal coaching movement or whatever. But he breaks stuff out as far as his doing stuff like creating reserves in your life where you've got stuff handled ahead of time before issues come up, where when you do have issues come up, you've got the capacity to deal with it rather than running on the ragged edge. And I've gotten an awful lot out of that, implementing those ideas over the years. And I would probably also mention Unlimited Power by Tony Robbins, I think was one of his best books. And I read that book and I got his tape program when I was first getting started. In fact, his tape program was one of the first things that I spent money on. It was $89 for 6 audio cassette tapes. That kind of dates me, right? If I'm saying audio cassette tapes. And I was thinking about it. I was thinking, $89 for 6 audio tapes? How can I possibly spend that kind of money? I mean, I'm an auto mechanic, right? And then I thought, well, wait a minute. I can't afford to spend that kind of money on a self-improvement program. But the person that I want to be, that person can afford to do that. So I'm going to go ahead and do it. So,
cool. Yep. So what if we go back to 1990 and you're still turning wrenches, you know, fixing cars for a living, and you had all the experience that you've now gained over the, you know, the 30 years that have come since, what would be the crown jewel of wisdom that you would go back and share with yourself then?
I think I would tell myself, you know, the obvious, do more faster. Don't poke. And I mean, when I got started, I did a duplex and then a 4-unit. I figured if I could do a duplex, I could get my courage up to do a 4-unit. Right. So, I think the other thing is I would probably encourage myself to look for ways to partner with people more rather than trying to figure out stuff on my own, whether it's putting a group of people together. I've done a lot of stuff over the years with masterminds where you get a group of people together that are all going in one direction where they can share ideas and encourage each other and all grow faster through the process. And those don't have to be paid. You can put those together if you find the right people without paying, you know, big fees like some people get for those. I think that I would tell myself to make the most of what I think is kind of a strange thing that really makes me perform, which is putting myself into situations where I have a, like this hiking the Appalachian Trail, you know, telling people I'm going to go do this. And then I had people following along, my journey. And I, you know, I felt like I couldn't stop even when I wanted to, or at least more pressure to succeed. So I think I would encourage myself to make the most of this weird character trait that I have, is that I can do amazing things when I'm doing it as a, with other people watching, or almost like a performance. I mean, for me to put a real estate deal together on my own, that's, you know, that's just another real estate deal. But if I can do it with some students there watching and learning and whatever, and it, that's like just so much fun to do it with, you know, a crowd watching. Plus it's like the pressure on me, like, oh, you know, oh my goodness, I can't, you know, I can't drop this one. So, and that, I don't know that would apply to most people. I think I'm weird that way.
That's an interesting piece. As you said, I think, like, you know, I've got, you know, three markets, many business partners. I do the podcast. I mean, I don't like, you know, I don't like come on and like brag about all my deals on the podcast, but certainly there's some element of when I'm all by myself at 8, 9 o'clock at night on any given night of the week, and I'm still working on something that has to do with my business or something that has to do with my deals, I think there's probably a part of me that has that drive because of that. Maybe it's like accountability to other people. It's accountability to my partners. It was accountability for you and your family and friends and everybody watching on the trail. And it's definitely a lot easier sometimes, I think, to show up, certainly for me, now with other people looking back at me expecting some kind of results, whether they're going to benefit from them personally or not. It's a lot easier for me to show up and do it than it was way back in 2006 when it was like only me showing up to do the real estate deal. So I think that probably, right, you know, also bolts in for the average person to like select the right partner, just like you talked about, or even get involved in those masterminds. I mean, there it is. You can get some accountability and some fans cheering, right?
Well, let's simplify it even more than that. Let's if you're going to do something, go tell as many people as you can. Here's what I'm going to, and be specific about it. Don't say I'm going to poke around, or I'm going to look into this, or I'm going to maybe do some real estate investing. Go tell them I'm committing. I'm going to, in 2020, I'm going to find a way to buy an investment property one way or another during 2020. And I want you to hold me accountable. I am going to do this. And you go around and tell enough people what you're going to do, you're putting the pressure on yourself to, you know, find a way to figure it out, right?
Yes, you are. So, yes, you are.
Yeah.
All right. So, Peter, do you have a website or some contact information or anything else you want to leave the listeners with as we wrap up here?
Well, you hit me at a good time because this past month I've been working like crazy, and I just published my latest book, which is called How to Profit with Commercial Lease Options. And what I'm doing is I'm releasing it just for the next little bit of time. So hopefully it'll still be available for those of you when you listen to this podcast, if it's way down the line, but it'll be available, you know, by the time this podcast goes out, certainly. I'm making it available as a free ebook. And if you just go to commercialleaseoptions.com, you can get a copy of that. And I want to get it out there and get some feedback, and then I have to figure out the publishing thing has changed since I published my last book a bit. But yeah, rather than paying $25 for it on Amazon, you can get the book for free. And it's got, I think, a lot of great stuff in much more detail. A lot of the stuff that we talked about negotiating and putting creative deals together on commercial properties. And I had a blast putting it together because I know people are going to read it. And so I felt like I was kind of performing as I was writing it.
Nice.
So, yeah. Yeah. But just go to commercialleaseoptions.com and you can get a copy of that as my gift to you. And good luck with all your investing for those of you who are listening.
Absolutely. Hey, Peter, we are at the top of our time together here. I really, really sincerely appreciate you closing out the distractions of life and giving us generously of your time and wisdom. And hey, thanks again for sending me that book years ago. I don't know if I'd be where I'm at today, right now as we speak, if it wasn't for, you know, that seed planted years and years ago. So I appreciate your time. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, thank you. Bless your heart. It makes me feel warm inside knowing that you got some value out of that. So thanks, Dan, for having me on. And thanks for all of you listening in.
And thank you, my friend, for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Next episode coming up is on leveraging legal counsel to grow your business with Chicago business attorney Denise Gearock. Highlights of that episode include buying and selling companies, as well as a few personal strategies for succeeding through the coronavirus shutdown. Are you enjoying the REI Diamond Show? Did you know that you can find these episodes posted on podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, as well as YouTube itself? Be sure to subscribe to receive early notification of new episodes. You can also sign up for the Saturday new episode notification email at reidiamonds.com. Accredited investors seeking double-digit returns investing passively in my real estate deals can go to www.fundrehabdeals.com to request information and also upcoming private mortgage investment opportunities. That concludes today's show. Catch you on the next one.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.